Good morning. I'm Alexis Strauss Hacker. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. I want to welcome you to today's meeting, which is our first of this new year, 2025. Before we get underway, we'd like to acknowledge friends, family, colleagues in the Los Angeles area. We've reached out to many of those partners and colleagues to offer our support and assistance, and want everyone affected to know that we stand with you in these times and look forward to the recovery. I think we may hear a bit more about that from our state board member as well. We'll call the roll for our board members in just a minute, but first, as ever, some logistics. Our meetings are hybrid, so in addition to those here in the conference room, we may also receive comment through the Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and intend to comment, please be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through our webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link listed on the agenda for today's meeting. And after you register, you will receive a Zoom login link providing access to our meeting. For those of you here in person who may wish to speak, you can also register online or with the assistance of our team at the registration table outside. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you. Please unmute yourself on your computer or your phone so that we can hear you. And when you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here waiting to speak, you'll be called by name. Please come to the podium where we can best see and hear you. Each speaker is given 3 minutes for comment, and we ask that you state your name and your affiliate organization when called upon. Before we ask our board clerk to call the roll, I just wanted to remind Board Member Batty and Board Member Kissinger, who are participating remotely, to let us know during roll call. One, if there's anyone in the room with you who's over 18, and two, to remind you to keep your camera on for the pendency of this part of the meeting. Thank you all for joining us today. We're looking forward to it. And now, Paula Castellanos, our clerk for today's board meeting, please call the roll.
Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Billing.
Here.
Board Member Batty.
I am here, calling in from New York, and I am by myself.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger.
I'm here as well, calling in from Hawaii, and I'm here also by myself.
Vice Chair Young.
Here.
And Chair Hacker.
I'm here. Thank you. Everyone, we have a quorum physically present for today's meeting. We welcome everyone. Our second agenda item is the public forum. I'd like to now open our meeting to the public forum and remind everyone that the public forum is for items not on the agenda today. You can speak on agenda items at the appropriate time during the meeting. The public forum is also not for items that are pending or an impending matter, which are about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Paula, who is seated here in the front of the auditorium with any questions you may have. I'll call on each of our registered public speakers, both online and here in person. If you are remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform by clicking on the reactions icon on your screen and then on the raise hand icon. That way, we'll know to promote and call on you during this forum. Again, each speaker has 3 minutes. You'll be timed and notified via the online timer visible on the screen. Thank you for your participation. Paula, do we have any registrations?
Yes, we have two registrations. We have Mr. Geoff Ellsworth going first.
Welcome, Mr. Ellsworth.
Jeff has been promoted.
Good morning, Mr. Ellsworth. Please unmute and go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate it. As challenging as it is, I'm here again to look at issues with Clover Flat Landfill, Upper Valley Disposal in Napa County. I'm here this morning to introduce for the record a 2024 resolution from the League of United Latin American Citizens, also known as LULAC, in support of the Latino workers at Upper Valley Disposal Service in Clover Flat Landfill in Napa County, bringing forward decades of wastewater, concerns, fire, and discrimination concerns at those jointly owned companies. This type of treatment of human beings should not be occurring in our local counties, in this state, or in this country, and certainly not by a company operating on exclusive no-bid government agency contracts, government agencies which should be holding them to the highest bar. I also recently shared this LULAC resolution with the California State Level Water Board and will continue presenting to additional agencies and organizations and working to get it revisited as we get into 2025. The recent Water Board report on these matters, unfortunately, did not interview all key witnesses and did not account, including neighbors, and did not account for all pertinent documentation and should be revisited in hearings with sworn testimony. The fire and contamination risks remain at these Napa County waste sites. And what we saw in Southern California with the fires should really hammer home the point that we must all do all we can to prevent any further fire disasters. One spark at the wrong time is all it can take. And garbage and waste have an inherent methane explosive flammable component. I'll now read a bit of this resolution within the allotted time frame. Thank you. So this says, whereas over two dozen Latino workers at Upper Valley Disposal Service, Clover Flat Landfill in Napa County, associated with Pestone Family Winery, have filed California state and federal complaints claiming unreasonable exposure to fires, smoke, and significant contamination without adequate protective equipment or training, as well as other workplace concerns, including discrimination and civil rights violations. And whereas, though Upper Valley Disposal Service Clover Flat Landfill has entered into new ownership structure, much of the same problematic management is still in place. Many of the old and unacceptable practices towards Latino workers have not been changed, and accountability has not been taken for long-term impacts and inequities, particularly toward Latino members of Upper Valley Disposal Service, Clover Flat Land, and the Clover Flat Landfill workforce. There are three other small paragraphs, which I will, what I'll do is submit this through email, but I just wanted you to be aware of this, and I appreciate the continued, at least listening to these concerns as things move forward with an eye on the civil rights aspects, but also the very concerning fire concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth. I appreciate your commitment to this and hope that in the coming months you will find full resolution of this matter. Let me check with our board clerk if there are any additional members of the public. Go ahead.
Yes, we have Haiti Taylor.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Heidi Taylor. I am a founding member of Healthy Martinez. I am a resident of Martinez and have been subjected to various events which has left our community covered in one toxic spent catalyst, in coke dust, and most recently the smoke from the fire at the PBF Martinez Refining Company. We have had enough. We have been at every meeting imaginable. I am here now because we have not engaged with the Water Board. We are appreciative of the last settlement for $4.4 million, but I'm here to say that we are relying on you to create more clear, enhanced regulations that can be enforced. This company has a pattern and practice of very bad behavior, of contaminating people, of contaminating animals, contaminating our water, and it has to stop. I don't know if the Water Board relies on MRC to self-report, but that can't happen. They have proven themselves not to be trustworthy. And again, we are depending on you to protect us. We are paying attention. We welcome more opportunities to engage with the Water Board. And please, please, on behalf of all of my friends and neighbors around here, please protect us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. I am sure it's been a very difficult time with regard to this facility. And I imagine you've also been raising concerns to the Bay Area Air District as well. And we are happy to continue to hear from you and any other members of the community during public forum. And thank you for acknowledging our compliance effort and penalty. Paula, are there other speakers?
We have one more registration, but we're just wondering where he is. So give us 1 second.
Sure.
He may be in person, Mr. Zachary Medina. He's not on Zoom either.
This is one last call in public forum for anyone to raise their hand. And if not, we'll move on. Let's move to item three, which is the annual election of a chair and vice chair. I'd like to turn it over to our executive officer, Eileen White.
Good morning, board members, staff, and members of the public. Chair Hacker was elected chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board at our February 2024 board meeting. The Water Code requires the election of the chair at its first regular meeting of the year, which is today. I've solicited by talking to each of the board members, and Chair Alexis Strauss Hacker has expressed interest in serving another term as a San Francisco Bay Water Quality Control Board chair. I recommend Chair Hacker solicit any additional nominations for Chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board for calendar year 2025, and we will then have the board vote on each nomination.
Are there nominations to serve as chair of the Regional Water Board under our shared governance ethic?
I nominate Alexis Strauss Hacker.
And I nominate Alexis Hacker.
Do we have any other nominations? I think if we have a nomination, we don't need a motion or a second, but we need to ask our board clerk to call the roll.
Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Bulin?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye, with enthusiasm.
Thank you, Bill.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
Chair Hacker?
Aye. Thank you to my dear colleagues.
Great. Congratulations, Chair Hacker. And next is the election of the Vice Chair of the Water Board. Vice Chair Young, who has served as our Vice Chair for the last year, has expressed interest in serving another term as Vice Chair for the San Francisco Bay Water Board. I recommend the Chair solicit any additional nominations for Vice Chair of our board and then call for a vote on each nomination.
I'd like to take nominations for the Vice Chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board.
I would like to nominate Donald Young also. I think he's doing a terrific job, and the three of you work very well together, as evidenced by how nice these meetings flow. So, thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other nominations? Paula, would you call the vote, please?
Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Bielan?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye, again with enthusiasm.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
And Chair Hacker?
Aye. Thank you, Donald. We look forward to serving you all. Very well. Let's proceed with item four, which reviews and acts upon our board meeting minutes from our December 11th meeting. Are there any edits or revisions to these minutes? Seeing none, may I please have a motion and a second to adopt these minutes?
I move adoption.
Second.
I'll second.
Moved by Board Member Gunther and first seconded by Board Member Bielan. Paula, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Bielan?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
And Chair Hacker?
Aye. Thank you. The December 11th, 2024 board meeting minutes have been adopted by this board. And we're moving to item five, which are board member updates, followed by our executive officer's report. But before we get into that, I'd like to take this time to acknowledge the career development and promotion of our dear Assistant Chief Counsel, Emel Wadhwani. Emel has been appointed Chief Counsel at the California Department of Resources, Recycling, and Recovery, famously known as CalRecycle. I would like at this time to welcome Emel on screen and to read a letter that our board has prepared with our executive officer recognizing Emel's contributions to this board. And then I'd like to ask board members if there's anything in addition they'd like to share, given our history of working with Emel. So dear Emel, welcome and good morning. The San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board thanks you for over 17 years of dedicated and inspiring service and wishes you much success in your new role as Chief Counsel of CalRecycle. Since joining the Water Board in 2008, you've provided strategic and thoughtful legal guidance to our board, to our executive officers, to our managers and staff. We have all appreciated your serenity in facing a broad array of challenging legal issues, consistently showing your ethical and civic-minded approach. You have so many fine qualities which have supported our efforts over the years, and we've been fortunate to work with you as a creative problem solver with attention to detail, an active listener, and an open, honest, and clear communicator. You have mentored and coached many Water Board colleagues, earning widespread respect. You've been patient, kind, and shown that you care for this organization and its people. You've been available to support us on many an evening and weekend. Thank you for your confident leadership and counsel. We know you to be an exceptional attorney and an extraordinary person. You've inspired many with your depth and breadth of knowledge, your legal insights, and collaborative approach. And in closing, our board is deeply grateful for all you've done in demonstrating passion, dedication, and inspirational leadership as a public servant to protect, enhance, and preserve California's water resources. We're very grateful, Emel, and wish you well. I'd like to turn to Bill and then Jane first for any remarks they'd like to make. Bill?
Well, I don't know exactly what to say. I don't view this move with enthusiasm, but only because of the loss that we'll have. You've been there since day one that I've been involved with the board, and it's been a long time. Everything that our chair said, I agree with 120%. You've just been stalwart, steady, and just a delight to work with. You've been there through the hiring of not one but two executive directors, and you've really at every step along the way helped us make the right decisions, and we really appreciate your contribution. I wish you the best.
So much.
Thank you, Bill. Jane?
Thanks. I mean, first of all, Alexis said it so well, Emel, but you've just been a delight to work with. I'm not sure how I'm going to get through some of the legal clearances that I need to get through to be on the board in the coming year, but somehow we'll muddle through. So thank you so much for all the support and guidance personally and with two executive officer processes is pretty significant. But I have to say, when I saw that you were going to CalRecycle, I was thrilled. They have some big adventures in front of them with extended producer responsibility. And I think they're going to need a good lawyer or two around. So I'm thrilled that you'll be there to help them in what I think is a really big step forward around waste management. So thanks, Emel, for everything.
Thank you.
I hope we'll stay in touch.
Definitely.
I know, Emel, that you will immediately be dealing with CalRecycle's role in Los Angeles fire recovery as part of the CalEPA family. And you will have all this amazing Water Board experience as the Water Board itself contributes. And we're going to hear more about that in a moment from Sean McGuire. But let me turn this over to you.
Yes, thank you so much, Alexis and everyone, all the board members and Eileen and her team. I am so touched Just wanted to start by thanking you sincerely both for inviting me. This is wonderful to be able to connect with you before I go off into my CalRecycle duties. Also for the beautiful flowers that Alexis brought by during my last week at the water boards from all of you. So that was really appreciated. Sincerely touched. So thank you. It's just been a great honor to work with this board and with Eileen and her team. You are all outstanding. You have some of the best minds working on extremely complex but very important issues. And my observation has been always that you're serving the region with just admirable attention, commitment, compassion. And so thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for the very kind words. I know you are in terrific hands with Stephanie. I hope you, if you haven't met her yet, that you meet her soon. You already know you're in terrific hands with Yuri and Chech. So you're great. You're going to do great. But I will personally, it's a personal loss for me to be able to continue, not be able to continue to work with you. So just wanted to convey that and my very sincere thanks for everything you're doing and for inviting me today to be part of this.
Thank you.
Well, best wishes. We hope to see you in some capacity, in some way.
We will be working together, I'm sure, still. So
best wishes then. Now we have given our state board liaison and board member, Sean McGuire, is next on our agenda. And Sean, the floor is yours. It's hard to follow a mail, isn't it?
It is. Actually, there's quite a bit that's hard to follow here. So, but it's very good to see you. And I guess I could still say Happy New Year because this is your first board meeting of the year. So I'll do that. And congratulations to you, Chair Hacker and Vice Chair Young, on your re-election there. I think that's fantastic news to see that there will be some continuity and strong leadership at the San Francisco Bay Regional Board this coming year. So I'm excited for that and really appreciate the relationship that we have between the state board and your regional board as well. So also congratulations to ML on your I agree, it's a big loss to the water boards generally to have you move along, but I'm so excited that you're staying in house, you're staying in the agency, maybe even in the building. And so yeah. Congratulations, and I wish you all the best at CalRecycle.
Thanks, Sean.
Yeah. And so, yes, true to the anticipation here, Chair Hacker, you did mention that I was going to provide a short update on the LA wildfire recovery, and I will. And I appreciate your kind words in the beginning there. I think we're all still wrestling with the gravity and magnitude of the impacts this wildfire has caused on many the communities that have been impacted over the last month. And, you know, it's not lost on me, too, that we're still in the rainy season and there's storms coming in. And that just can only exacerbate some of the challenges that we find at the water boards when we're thinking about water quality impacts from the fire scarred landscape on creating mudslides and, moving contaminants from the hazardous debris that's still present on all these locations. So there's a lot to grapple with, but I'm really been proud and impressed by the response that our water board's team has jumped in to help the administration and to help the communities and water systems and dischargers in the area with the response to this tragedy. So the state board has been, this is just for your awareness, the state board has been participating directly in response and recovery efforts through its Division of Drinking Water and our Emergency Management Program, which is really the program that's set up to respond to any disaster scenario that pops up anywhere around the state when they're called upon. So they've been working in close coordination with the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board and providing technical support to drinking water systems that have been impacted by the fires, advising on drinking water notices, shutoff notices, boil water, and inspecting for damage to ensure those systems can continue to deliver safe drinking water to those communities. Our emergency management program staff are currently deployed to the California Office of Emergency Services Debris Removal Task Force, and they're focused now on transitioning to removing that household debris and hazardous waste. And then there's also a Cali OES Watershed Debris Flow Task Force, which is looking at mitigating the post-fire debris flow and contaminated runoff. Some of these, the big risks that we're currently facing right now. So our State Water Board staff are also supporting interagency coordination and external communications. And all the water boards are also, in some cases, volunteering to help support recovery efforts and advise on best management practices and different things that they're looking at to help protect water quality during debris removal and, in particular, some of these rainfall events. So that's my update. The fine print is there's actually a whole lot more going on than that. There's lots of details and lots of support and coordination. So I've been getting periodic updates on this and just have been really impressed with the professionalism and response and that we've seen from the water boards. And this is not the first time. There's been a number of, unfortunately, we're in this world that we live in. We've seen catastrophic wildfires that impact a number of communities around the state in the last several years. And I would say that our program has only become more and more adept at responding and providing support to those impacted communities. So thank you to them. I think I always say this, there's a lot going on. And that remains true in 2025. And so I'm not going to get into any additional policy priority matters right now, unless you have any questions about any of the work that we have going on at the State Water Board. I'm happy to field those questions. I just since we're kicking off the year, just wanted to provide a couple of personnel related updates to you in case those are of interest. The first is on our board. So you had your board update here just now, and I'm happy to share with you that our chair, Joaquin Esquivel, and also board member Nicole Morgan, were reappointed by the governor to the State Water Board again last month. So we're very happy to hear about their reappointments, and obviously they'll be going through the Senate confirmation process. But again, just happy for the continuity of the State Water Board during this time. We also are embarking on a bit of a transition ourselves with our staff, in that Chief Deputy Director Jonathan Bishop, who I'm sure you all know, has announced that he's retiring in a couple of months. And so we're in the process right now of, and this is a little bit of a pitch for me, for anyone who's listening, we're in the process of recruiting to fill those big shoes that Jonathan will be leaving behind in one of the Chief Deputy Director roles at the State Water Board. So if anyone's interested or knows somebody who may be interested in that type of high-level executive management position, please reach out to me and I'd be happy to connect you with some more materials on that. There will be more to come on Jonathan, I'm sure, in the coming months here, but just wanted to tee up that effort is the recruitment effort is currently underway and is very critical to our board. And the last thing I wanted to say is I hope to see you all again soon. And where I hope to see you all is at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting on May 1st and 2nd in Sacramento. And you should have that information. Hopefully, it has been shared with you and you have a save the date on your calendars. Unfortunately, we had to cancel the Water Quality Control Coordinating Committee meeting last October. So I'm very excited. It seems like it's been a long time now, and it has. So I'm very excited, hopefully, to see some or all of you at that meeting. I certainly will be there. And stay tuned in terms of the topics and the agenda and what's to come on that. But just wanted to make sure you're all aware and looking at it, because this year is going to go by quick and May will be here before we know it. So hopefully we'll see you soon. And that is all I had planned to share with you. But like always, happy to answer any questions that you have. Thank you.
It's terrific having you be part of our meetings, and we really appreciate your time and your updates. I will mention that I had been advocating with Chair Esquivel that this in the fire recovery is a great opportunity for those very small water systems, the four that are still down, where people don't have access to safe drinking water, the opportunity to, in some ways, consolidate. I know he was going to be talking with the city of Pasadena about that, and I'm hopeful that we can see not what FEMA would consider betterment, but betterment for people in terms of having a more reliable source of safe drinking water. And the same is probably true of the handful of septics that remain in the Eaton fire landscape. Great time to connect to the LA County collection system, but we shall see what can come of that. It would be a pity to rebuild small systems and septics if we don't have to, although I know there's a very significant cost consideration, but this is an opportunity as well, despite all the suffering. But I know many of us will be looking forward to joining you at WQCC, and we've always had very robust Board 2 turnout there. So thank you. Are there any questions for Sean? If not, Sean, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for the update. And I'm going to just go around to each of our board members with their update. I'll start with our two remote participants. Jane, any update?
Sorry, I was expecting to go second. I have two quick things. At the very end of January, I attended an evening panel and conversation hosted by the Water Foundation. It was attended by about 45 people. It was a home-based conversation. Great attendance, and it was really wonderful to see the level of engagement around water quality, and not just in California, but around the country. Chair Esquivel was there and was one of the speakers, and Celeste Cantu, who I believe is chair of the Water Board down in San Diego. She's also chair of the Water Foundation. And so it was a great opportunity to connect with people that are passionate and aligned with the work we're doing to protect and enhance water quality and also address climate change impacts. The second thing I'll just mention is that I have been invited to speak at a relatively new incubator organization in Half Moon Bay, which is encouraging clean tech and climate-related tech. And they've asked me to come speak about the work of the Water Board and the role we play in the region. And Eileen has kindly given me a PowerPoint to work with for that. So that's coming up in March now, I think it is. And that's it for me. Thanks.
Bill.
Thanks, Chair Hecker. Nothing from me.
Chair, Member Beelin.
Nothing from me either.
Vice Chair Young.
It's the new year, but nothing for me. Thank you.
Member Ransom. I'm counting on Board Member Gunther.
I won't let you down. I would ask the indulgence for a few minutes from my board members and the staff. Observing the recent events on the national stage, I'm reminded of Thomas Jefferson's statement that no nation is permitted to live in ignorance with impunity. The federal government is now acting with total disregard for scientific reality, and this will impact the beneficial uses of the waters of our region and our state, and the work of the Water Board. I want to share with you just three examples. President Trump adopted executive orders that will, by design, accelerate climate disruption through increasing fossil fuel use and sabotaging the transition to renewable energy. the president seeks to make the market for fossil fuels as big as possible and to lock in oil and gas demand for the long term, which is directly at odds with our goals for the resources that are in our trust. President Trump ordered federal agencies to stop using the social cost of carbon when assessing the benefits and costs of their actions. This means that it is now federal government policy to purposefully ignore the known costs of climate change and the known costs of adverse health impacts associated with fossil fuel combustion. This is as irrational as outlawing antibiotics, seatbelts, or fire-safe roofs. The new president, based on fabricated claims that offshore wind turbines, quote, kill whales and cause cancer, unquote, is attempting to destroy the growth of carbon-free sources of electricity for the U.S. Meanwhile, 25 U.S. ports are investing in facility upgrades to support this new global industry. By increasing greenhouse gas emissions, the president's actions will make the impacts of climate change worse for generations. For us in the Bay Area, it means greater aridity, increasing the intensity of floods, heat waves, and wildfires, and accelerating sea level rise. And it is critical to note also that the president is directly challenging the science-based approach to public policy that we have treasured and fostered at this agency and more broadly across the Bay Area. This approach to public policy lies at the heart of our ability to act rationally, collaboratively, and regionally. Science is the joint language of all stakeholders. And so consequently, I intend to defend our science-based approach in order to protect our past accomplishments and to foster successful completion of the vital tasks before us. I encourage all of you to join me by seeking opportunities in your own work to hold the line against Trump's attacks, which, if left unchallenged, will undermine all that we have worked so hard to establish. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And thank you to our board. I'd like to call on our executive officer for her report.
Great. Since this is the beginning of the new year, I thought I'd take a minute to share with you some thoughts on the executive officer report this month and really every month. There's a tremendous amount of work that contributes to our mission of enhancing and protecting the waters of the Bay that occur every single day, but they don't necessarily require a vote or approval by the board. So the executive officer's report is really just our opportunity to share with you some of these significant accomplishments, many of which have taken a great amount of person years to achieve. And I just want to be clear that I'm only doing a few, but there's so much work that our incredible team at the Water Board does every day, and it just doesn't come to the board. But I wanted, you know, to highlight a few this month in particular. So several of the items in this month's report represent some of this phenomenal work. You heard a member of the public today under public forum talk about the Martinez Refinery Company. Well, the work of the Martinez Refinery Company enforcement and supplemental environmental projects was highlighted. The resolution of the ongoing dispute with the Oakland Army Base, it had been going on for 7 years, is now resolved. The case closure of the former IBM cleanup site in San Jose. Each one of these started with a spark and a passion from one of our technical team members and survived, some of them, generations, for example, the IBM, of Water Board staff engagement and commitment to persevere through many internal and external challenges. I'm just going to hit on them briefly. The Martinez Refinery Company enforcement is the largest civil liability ever from the San Francisco Bay Water Board. We were able to channel the settlement dollars into 6 environmentally beneficial projects. Kudos to the team members who made that happen and our fabulous attorneys. I want to give kudos to the team who resolved the ongoing dispute with the Army to remove PCB in the sediment from the Bay, which will allow the West Oakland community to expand the East Bay Regional Park District and support healthy fishing for the community. Special thanks to our attorneys once again. And finally, at last, the cleanup of the former IBM site in San Jose, one of the oldest cleanup sites in our region, and a small piece of technology history representing one of the unintended consequences of technological progress. But we dealt with it. Each of these updates in the executive officer's report represents a tremendous amount of work requiring the collaboration of our team with both internal stakeholders and external stakeholders. Our committed staff bring their passion and expertise to this work each day, through rain and shine, through setbacks and diversions, and I'm proud to say we'll continue to do so along with our support and encouragement. The executive officer report this month and each month is our opportunity to share with you and the public a snapshot of the accomplishments that our team are engaged with to enhance and protect the waters of the Bay. Thank you for the opportunity to continue to serve the public and the environment, and we want to thank you, the board, for all your support. Thank you.
We very much appreciate the care that goes into preparing items in the executive officer report from all of the team. And it is notable to bring to a close long-running projects. I remember the front end of the Oakland Army Base dispute and my inability at EPA to resolve it. So I'm very happy that you resolved it, Eileen. And I'm delighted to see that many of the early Superfund sites in Silicon Valley are getting to that point where, as our work diminishes, if not wraps up, there's plenty of other work that rushes in to fill that void. So thank you. I'm keen to hear, as things progress, about our role and the progress in the Radius Recycling West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project team that involves a number of folks. It's right here in our backyard. There's a lot to do, which also has implications for how we as a state deal with the other several facilities like Radius statewide. So do keep us up to date. And I wanted to, in fact, as a result of your executive officer report, I wanted to thank both Alec Noggle and Robert Schliff for their 25 years of service. It's been a pleasure to know that we have your depth of experience and talent, that we can rely on you unquestionably for what you bring. So thank you so very much and congratulations.
Madam Chair, Jane has her hand raised.
Please go ahead. Thank you, Paula. Jane, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to say, first of all, Eileen, thank you for such a thorough report. And it just seemed like so many things are getting done. And so I really appreciate the closure that's happening around so many things. I wanted to ask if you could, just following up a bit on Board Member Gunther's comments, can you give us an update at all around, with the shift in administration in Washington, D.C., are you seeing implications for us or our partners related to shifts that are happening in the federal government?
Yeah, I can answer that. So things continue to change day from day to day. But the good news is we continue to work with our partners. Early on, the first few days of the change in administration, federal agencies couldn't participate in meetings with other federal agencies, but that's lifted. I had a very good meeting yesterday. I was telling our chair, Hacker, about with EPA out of DC, EPA here, Region 9, the Navy, our own team, DTSC. So I'm beginning to see that we're working together well again. They have yet to appoint a new Region 9 administrator, so they have an acting administrator. With regard to some of the executive orders, I can let you know that the State Water Board's chief counsel is reviewing the different executive orders. DOJ is reviewing the executive orders to make sure they're consistent with the powers that go with the office. And our state's been involved in a number of lawsuits regarding some of the executive orders that have been signed. The other thing that we closely watch is with regard to funding. Some funding has been paused. It's impacted, you know, some of the nonprofits, impacted some state agencies. So that's something we're watching very closely, is the funding that I think that Board Member Gunther was referring to with regard to the executive orders. I know San Francisco Estuary Institute's concerned about some of their funding has been paused. The Water Quality Improvement Fund that EPA put out a solicitation for grants last October. I got an email on Tuesday night at 7:30 from EPA saying that that was all stopped right now. So we're continuing to follow. A lot of things have been paused, but then our settlement discussions with the city of San Francisco were supposed to occur. Those were canceled because EPA out of DC could not attend and neither could the attorneys out of DC, but now we're rescheduled for March. So I think things are happening and we're continuing. The good news is we're continuing to work very closely as a team at the Water Board and with our staff partners that we already have good working relationships with at EPA and the other federal agencies. So we continue to follow it. Also, we're keeping track and sharing information with our chief counsel at the State Water Board. I've been sending him some late night emails. So we're continuing to do our good work here with the Water Board, and we're continuing to stay focused. Early on, some of our work involving other federal agencies had to be rescheduled meetings, but they're getting rescheduled, and we're looking forward to continue to make progress on Hunter's Point and other projects that we work with the federal agencies. So can continue to keep you updated. One thing that I am closely watching is funding in particular. That's something that I've been working with state board staff on.
Yeah, yes. I'll just follow up and say that, you know, I appreciate, I'm sure we all appreciate the, if you could keep us updated and to understand what the implications are, because we, you know, we depend on our partners so much. And so there's a fair amount of chaos right now, but as things start to become more clear, it would be great to continue to have updates on this conversation. Thank you.
Anything further? If not,
Bill has his hand raised.
Bill, please go ahead.
Thanks very much. So I had a kind of a pedestrian question, but then it ties into the questions that Board Member Batty just raised a moment ago. It pertains to the Oakland Army Base settlement or resolution. It, you know, there's a line in your report, Eileen, about transitioning to a formal dispute in 2021. Can you say a little bit about what that means and what that ultimately resulted in? And what I specifically, does it result or did it result in some binding agreement? Is it something that's before a court? What was the process that resulted in this resolution? And I guess just to cut to the chase, picking up on Board Member Batty's questions, does the change in the administration, depending on what it was that we entered into by way of an agreement with the Army, is that subject to any kind of reopener or walking away by the new administration? Is there a court that's overseeing this? What's the status of what it is we have with the Army?
Great. And Yuri, feel free to add on to what I'm going to say. But first off, there's a federal facilities agreement that kind of lays out the framework for how we work with our federal partners on these sites, such as Oakland Army Base. And so what happened is the dispute has, as I mentioned, was going on for over 7 years. It started at a staff level. And per the federal facilities agreement, if they can't resolve it at a staff level, it gets elevated. So it eventually got elevated up and up to basically my level. And part of the reason it took so long and my frustration is that then there'd be changes. So DTSC, we make progress. The next thing, the top several layers at DTSC are gone. The Army continued to have change. And so, and then we got concerned with the change in the administration, what could come. And we've seen that with a couple of items that I've been working on that they had to pull out and say, Eileen, we need to wait until we know what our new administration wants. So we're very happy to get this across the finish line before the change in administration. So, oops, he went offline. Is he still there? So basically, we resolved, it was both us, and it was complicated because we had our issues and DTSC had their issues. So the, and DTSC and the Water Board are basically sister agencies. We all work under Cal EPA. So we worked together. Yuri worked with their attorney at DTSC. And so it was not only us getting agreement, we also wanted to make sure that DTSC got agreement on the issues that they wanted regarding a land use covenant. And so that actually delayed it quite a bit. But in the end, we got it all. And I think we're happy to move forward. As you know, this is in an area in a disadvantaged community. This land could be used for so much more. So this has stalled the cleanup, and now the cleanup can move forward.
Bill, I'd just add a postscript to that, that this is sort of a, there is a formula for what is essentially an administrative process, and ultimately can go up to the EPA administrator and secretary of the Army for final decision making. So as Eileen described, that escalation, fortunately, we didn't have to get to those levels in this case, but it relies on timely escalation of the issues that are, you know, in dispute.
And is there now in place a binding commitment, or is it at this point and subject to being revisited?
So, Mr. Kissinger, so yes, we, one thing first is that it was elevated. Mike Montgomery, when he was executive officer, you know, thought we reached an agreement, but it somehow the Army backed out, and then it was elevated to the highest level, which is Cal EPA and the governor's office. But there was a delegation where the agencies could act on their behalf. So we continued to negotiate with the Army, and it resulted in a dispute resolution statement where we agree on how we're going to move forward. So there is an agreement, and we are carefully watching whether it is being implemented.
Thank you, Yuri.
Right. Anything further on the executive officer report? Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of things. You mentioned impacts from EPA. I watched pictures and read reports that the Corps of Engineers was, in essence, decided to dump 1 billion gallons of water into Tulare Lake for a reason, and it was actually something that threatened safety of people downstream and everything. Has the Corps of Engineers done anything in our region, or could there be actions impending that would have such serious implications?
So we're continuing to work with our partners at the Corps. Things have, you know, been fluid, I would say. And that was a different, that those aren't people we work with. That's what I used to work with at East Bay Mud when I ran a water system. Yeah. So they released the water as they were directed to do. So we're continuing to work with our partners, and it's, as I said, it continues to change, and we'll continue to keep you updated. It's new for them too, for the staff level, USGS, even EPA. EPA, they were ordered back to work the third week in February, 5 days a week. So things keep changing for them too. So we're kind of just watching, and we're continuing to do our work and engage as much as we can.
Right. But as far as you know, there's no action that our partners here could be forced to take that could have those kind of implications for residents of the Bay Area or the resources or beneficial uses of the region?
There could be. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not going to happen. We don't know at this point.
Okay. Well, I hope we will at least ponder what could happen so that we're ready in case some, what I consider to be a foolish order is given.
So what we're seeing now with the Corps in terms of working with them very closely and dredging is there's thus far there hasn't been any change.
Thank you. Okay.
But as Eileen mentioned, it's a very fluid situation, and we don't know what's going to happen today or tomorrow necessarily.
Thanks. So Eileen, as I listen to your report, I come to the conclusion that all of this is making government operate less efficiently. Would you agree with that?
I would say definitely at the federal level, definitely.
Okay.
I mean, we had, as I said, settlement discussions scheduled. They were scheduled in December for last week, and we had to cancel them. So that was just an example, and we were making good progress. Right. So I look upon it. You got to, it's a little barrier, but we're gonna stay positive, and we're gonna keep moving forward with our work. When we work with our federal partners, it may be a bit slower because they have to follow their chain of command, and there's a lot of new people at the highest levels that they need to bring up to speed and then be told what direction that they want. Right. And so we're trying to be empathetic to them because a lot of them are career servants, USGS, Corps of Engineers, EPA staff. So we're continuing to work with them, and we're also finding out, talking to other EOs, that we're getting a lot of a lot more applicants for our jobs at the state, and a lot of people from federal agencies are looking to join the state agencies.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear the federal workforce might be taking a shot, but I understand that, and I'm glad that we're doing what we can to support the people who do the work.
Right.
Two things in your report. One, I was very, very pleased to read about the development and the successful application of a standard form for SEP project. Development, project description, development proposals, and implementation. As in a previous life, I was seeking SEPs, and it would not only was it complicated, but then many of the organizations that had the option to support an SEP were just saying, "I'd rather just pay the money. It's too complicated." So I think that's great. I think that over time, these things could be have a great impact on the region. And then lastly, as I was looking at the exemplary 25-year careers of Mr. Nagel and Mr. Schiff, it occurs to me that, and then looking at how long it's taken to complete the IBM cleanup, it occurs to me that the development and the maintenance of long-term staff at the board is actually a strategic goal if we are to complete effectively these incredibly long-term projects before us. So I think that might be, as we think about revising the strategic plan, I think that just some mention of how we work to foster the effective work and the long-term commitment of the staff of the agency, the evidence of which sits right before me here, that's actually something that helps us do these incredible jobs. And in fact, the IBM project itself might be worth illustrating to the public as a sense of what it really takes to clean up a toxic site, which, that's only five words or whatever, but it takes 30 years. So so I think that would help people understand our work. And also just the level, again, I'll reiterate what was said before, the level of accomplishment that is being demonstrated in your report is great. I would appreciate, even if you can't explain everything in detail in your report, to note things that have been accomplished so that we can see that and ask if we have more questions.
Great, thank you.
Very well, let's move to agenda item 6. We have uncontested items. I'll start with the oath and then we'll progress to a couple of logistical matters. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth, by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that's reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to these matters will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of this board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand. Do you promise to tell the truth? Thank you. Before we proceed with these uncontested items on the board calendar, Board Member Kissinger would like to make a statement on one. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Hacker. I'm going to recuse myself from item 6B, which is the City of San Francisco and North Bayside System Unit at the San Francisco International Airport. For the record, I'm a partner at Morgan Lewis & Bockius, which represents the City and County of San Francisco Public Utilities Commission on unrelated matters to the reissuance of the San Francisco Airport Permit. Because I do that work directly with regard to the SFPUC, albeit unrelated to this item, I'm going to recuse myself to avoid any potential conflict of interest or appearance of bias. So I'll recuse myself from item 6B.
Thank you. Eileen, would you continue with these uncontested board items?
Sure. So all four items are uncontested. So kudos to the team and our stakeholders. The first one is the MPDS permit for the City of Benicia wastewater treatment plant. 6B is the one that Board Member Kissinger is recusing himself, and that's the MPDS permit for the wastewater treatment plant for San Francisco International Airport. Item 6C is for the MPDS permit for the City of Palo Alto's Regional Water Quality Control Plant and Sanitary Sewer System. And then item 6D basically is to rescind waste discharge requirements from East Bay MUD because they're going to decommission some Bayside wells and four associated monitor wells due to a lease agreement ending and East Bay MUD no longer having need for these. And so they're all very straightforward. Just want to thank the staff. And I would recommend the board adopt all four uncontested items. And since Board Member Kissinger is recusing himself from item 6B, the reissuance of the MPDS permit for item 6B, the City and County of San Francisco and North Bay System Unit at the airport, I recommend the board vote on item 6A, C, and D first, and then separately on 6B.
Thank you. Let me turn to the board. Do you have any questions or comments?
I just want to reiterate that the fact that these are uncontested, these are some very major facilities in our region, and to you and Bill and your NPDS staff, this is incredible work. Thank you so much.
I wanted to thank some of the representatives of the permittees for being present today to answer questions. We really appreciate your very constructive work with our staff to get to this point of keeping our permits current. I wanted to thank each of our permit writers, Alessandra Moyer, Robert Schliff, and William Burrell for the work before us. And I wanted to make note, first of all, it's not germane to how we vote, but I just was noting in the packet for the City of Benicia Wastewater Treatment Plant that the discharger has the ability, but for money and other logistical challenges, to switch out almost 2 million gallons per day or 2,000 acre feet per year with the Valero refinery in terms of how we could get to more use and reuse of water and recycled water. And I appreciate the fact that they went through the process of looking at the feasibility. They're technically feasible, but they have funding challenges. And that's such a large amount of water. And one wishes that in these times it were possible for us to move forward with that. And I wanted to thank the City and County of San Francisco for its investment in recycling, in its nitrogen removal project, and to test its PFAS removal project. And I'm keen to hear how those progress with time. And lastly, City of Palo Alto, very exciting that the city is investing in a horizontal levee project and expanding and improving their recycled water and also looking at nitrogen reduction. I just feel that there's just such a positive menu of work represented in the permits before us today. And I wanted to thank you and thank you for coming today. And so with that, Is there a motion and a second to approve items 6A, 6C, and 6D on the uncontested calendar?
So moved.
So moved.
All right. It was moved by Vice Chair Young and seconded by Board Member Beelen. Paula, would you call the vote, please?
Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Beelen?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
Chair Hacker?
Aye. Good work. Thank you so much. Is there a motion and a second to approve item 6B, the reissuance of the permit for the City and County of San Francisco on the uncontested calendar?
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Board Member Beelen and seconded by Board Member Ransom. Paula, would you call the vote, please?
Board Member Ransom?
Aye.
Board Member Beelen?
Aye.
Board Member Gunther?
Aye.
Board Member Batty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Young?
Aye.
And Chair Hacker?
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger has recused himself.
Very well. I wanted to thank all of those present. I suggest we take a 2-minute break just to stand up before we sit down and continue with item 7. I'm just about ready for us to resume.
Just waiting on the key.
No, we're waiting on nobody. Eileen, would you like to proceed with the informational items, starting with item 7?
Certainly. So one of our board members mentioned the climate crisis earlier. So to help address the climate change crisis, the Public Policy Institute of California, known as PPIC, the Water Policy Center, produced a report late last year to recommend policy approaches to address critical challenges today, while also preparing for an uncertain, different future under climate change. The report emphasizes an adaptation planning approach that considers a suite of potential actions triggered by thresholds to prepare for multiple future scenarios. We're very fortunate today to have Leticia Greiner, the director of the PPIC Water Policy Center, and she's going to provide an overview of the report and summarize the conclusions of the report. Thank you, Leticia.
I also want to acknowledge Board Member Batty, who recommended that we invite you to speak on this topic. So welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here. Figure out which part I need my glasses on for. That's how old I've gotten. Okay. So I'm delighted to be able to present this to you. I don't know how well the regional board knows the Public Policy Institute of California. We are a research nonprofit, nonpartisan. And the Water Policy Center in particular historically has focused on, at the state level, on freshwater policy, and so a little bit less on coastal work. With me coming into this role about a year and a half ago now, and my background in a lot of coastal and estuarine work, where we are including coastal policy more, but you'll see just to sort of contextualize this presentation, it really is state level and a lot, and it does reflect all the different water sectors, and with a focus on freshwater. Next slide. So what I'm going to present to you today, it came out of a report that we do every year called Priorities for California's Water. And this one reflects our strategic plan. So about every 5 years, we do a strategic plan. And the two themes that came out of our strategic planning, which had a lot, which was really focused on a big listening tour and talking to dozens and dozens of folks in different water sectors, was one, are we ready for climate change? You know, how are we doing on climate adaptation was one big question. And the other one was, can we adapt to a changing climate and provide more equitable outcomes around water? So I have to laugh that these are not the priorities of our current federal administration. We've sort of nailed two of the things that are not the priorities of the current federal administration. Anyway, one of the ideas that we promulgated in this report was thinking about adaptation pathways. And this is something here in the Bay Area that you're probably very familiar with, but it's a new way to plan. Instead of planning for one future target date and one future and then building infrastructure or creating policy for that moment, it's really about recognizing that we are facing many different potential futures and that we need to create pathways of planning that allow us to be ready for those many different futures. And this is a figure that shows that for tidal marsh, which has been a focus in this region, you know, how do we keep those marshes protecting our shorelines and providing other services, despite the fact that we don't exactly know when sea level rise is going to get to these different levels, and we don't exactly know some other things that are going to happen along the way. So we propose that this approach that really has come from the sea level rise world, but is now, is now worldwide and also being integrated into other planning sectors should be a consideration. Next slide, for how we prepare for climate change overall. These are the water sectors we looked at: water supply and water quality for communities, water supply and water quality for farms, headwaters and wildfire. The changes in wildfire are really affecting what's happening with water infrastructure and other elements of water supply and water quality, flood management and ecosystem health. Now, I know for this region, the last two items are most important, so I'm going to breeze through the earlier items very quickly. Next slide. For each of these, we actually came up with a grade, an overall assessment of how are we doing in terms of climate adaptation. So first I'll talk about water supply and water quality for communities and farms. Next slide. There are many current challenges that I won't go into, but happy to talk about if we have time for questions. Next slide. Climate effects, unfortunately, essentially make all of those challenges worse and add some new ones. So that's going to be a pattern you're going to see across the board. As we think about climate adaptation, we have many things we're already dealing with, but what we have to deal with in the future is often new and different and worse. So we have to figure out how do we do the planning for that future while dealing with our current challenges, and then how are we going to pay for it all, I think, is another question that really remains to be answered. Next slide. We do come up with lots of different recommendations about how we can adapt, and a big one here around adapting to what's going to feel like water scarcity. Even though we're going to have about the same amount of precipitation, it's going to feel like water is more scarce due to the patterns with which the water is delivered and just the warmer atmosphere is groundwater recharge. So when we have water in our big water years, we really need to manage it better. Next slide. And so for water for communities, we gave them the highest grade that we gave of the three grades, making good progress. Doesn't mean there aren't problems, but in this area, this graph just shows how well we're doing in urban water conservation. Even though our population has gone up, we don't use more water in urban areas. Water sector, there's been collaboration for decades. There's been focus on resilience and portfolios of water supply. So there's really a long history here of being adaptive and sort of already preparing for more scarce water supply. And so I think that's why they got the highest grade. Next slide. When we come to water for farms, there is very difficult work underway. A lot of this is because that sector is currently adjusting to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act right now. And so it's been 10 years, or actually 11 now, since the act was passed, but the actual compliance is coming now, is starting to happen with the sustainability plans. So we're getting to the point where people are really feeling this, and there are many issues coming to the forefront. So we gave this our middle grade of difficult work underway. This is more in the process of making those difficult adjustments, but there is focus, there is money, there is research, so it is happening. We're heading in the right direction in this sector. Next slide. Let's talk about headwaters and wildfires. It's, of course, a top of mind for lots of us in California recently due to the wildfires in LA. Next slide. There are many current challenges, and a lot of what we hear about is focused on our woody ecosystems, so our forests. But when we think about chaparral in Southern California, it's a different deal. So there are really different approaches we need to take for the different ecosystems in the state. Next slide. Climate effects will make it much worse. And a lot of what we can do here, though, next slide, in terms of adaptation measures, is to undo some of our poor historical forest management. So we kind of know what to do here, but now it's harder because of climate change. We have to restore forests after they burn. We can't just let them grow back. Often they will now grow back as shrubland. So that's what climate change has brought us, that we don't necessarily get our conifer forests back afterward. Happy to talk about this again. We could go really deep here, but I want to move on in the interest of time. Next slide. So here again, we gave that middle grade of difficult work underway because of the unfortunate disasters we've been having now for like the past 8 years, the terrible fires. There is this focus. There are now state and federal goals on acres of forests that need to be treated every year. They are ambitious. The funding isn't necessarily clear, but there again is that research and focus that makes us think that the difficult work is underway. Next slide. All right, now we're going to go to our last two sectors, and these are the two that Region 2 is probably most interested in, flood management, and you can see here that we're talking about both riverine and coastal flooding, and then we'll talk about freshwater ecosystems at the end. Next slide. So in the situation of flood management, we are not in good shape. Our infrastructure is aging and outdated. Many of these, much of our infrastructure was built, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. Those standards are dated and insufficient, including our flood maps, but also just the standards of, how things were built or conceived of. The design standards were really different in terms of what kind of benefits and functions we want this infrastructure to provide. There's very low insurance uptake and a lack of incentives. So even though about 20% of California's population is in a flood zone, of that 20% within those flood zones, only 7% have insurance. So we're talking 93% of people who could be flooded don't have insurance. So there's a lack of incentives to take up that insurance, and there are definitely equity issues involved there. Flood management has really constrained funding. It's essentially a fiscal orphan. There's no steady revenue stream, and so projects happen kind of randomly when the money comes in. That is not sufficient for our flood risk. We kind of forget in California, especially because we're having all these fires, that we're a flood-prone state. If we had the 1861, 1862 flood now, the estimated damages are $1 trillion. So let's hope that doesn't happen, but if you look at the science, the probability of that happening is doubling now every 50 to 25 years. So this is, by the time my kids are grown up, that flood would be predicted to happen twice. So that's kind of scary. Maybe we'll get away without it, some of us who are older, but it is coming. We also have inadequate forward-looking planning. A lot of the ways that we operate, even like our standards for how we operate our infrastructure, our flood risk infrastructure, is not updated. And then there's major issues of equity. Who gets flooded and how well they recover is really disadvantaged communities tend to be disproportionately impacted. And we see that over and over again. I could refer to the floods in San Diego in 2024. Floods in Pajaro in 2023. This is not like an abstract idea that could happen in the future. This is pretty much happening every year that we get decent rain. Next year. Next slide. Here again, climate effects are going to make this worse. The predictions are that storms will become more intense, creating more intense flood peaks. So we're going to have these intense dry periods, but when we get rain, we're going to get a lot of rain. This volatility complicates reservoir operations. Do you hold your water because you're worried that you need it for water supply because there's going to be drought, or do you let it go because you're going to have a huge bunch of water coming in a flood? Rising sea level also increases coastal flood risk, as you're all well aware. I think one of the things for the coast to think about that you're aware of, but where we don't really have the science and information yet, is combined coastal flooding risk. So that's increasing, but this means when you've got a riverine flood coming down, you've also got a high tide or a king tide and maybe a storm with storm surge and wind waves, and that is actually also pushing up the groundwater. So we know that raising of the groundwater can bring up contaminants. All those three things together, you can't really easily put on a map. You have to do site-specific modeling to understand that local combined flood risk. And so it's one of these things that we tend not to fully appreciate how high that risk could be. It reminds me a little bit of the ice melting in terms of how much sea level rise is going to be. Sea level rise estimates were low for many years because the scientists didn't have those numbers to add ice melting in, and then suddenly they jumped up when those numbers got added in. I think if we could see the real risk of combined coastal flooding, we might realize that we have a much higher risk than we're anticipating. Next slide. So what can we do about it? We need to modernize our planning. We need to modernize our infrastructure using natural and updated built infrastructure. We desperately need new funding opportunities. We need to incentivize insurance. And we all understand that we can't protect everyone from flooding. It's flood risk management. It's not flood protection. And so we always are going to need better emergency response and recovery. We're getting it now for fires, but we don't necessarily have that yet for floods. Next slide. And these are just some maps showing for the 500-year floodplain how many people and how the value of structures. This is a little bit outdated now, but we're talking major flood risk in our state, which is not really well appreciated, how many people and how much infrastructure we have in harm's way. So here, unfortunately, we get the lowest score that we gave overall. Major overhaul needed. There are big problems. We do not see attention and focus and research and funding to solve these problems. I want to say, again, this is a statewide look, including river and flooding. Here in the Bay Area, I think, is where there's a spark of light and hope in terms of all the work that's been done on sea level rise and the regional regional RSAP. I'm forgetting what that stands for. But the work with BCDC, and I know there's an MOU here to really be a leader in terms of this kind of preparation. And I think, you know, the funding of that, if this region can show how that can get funded, would be a huge model for the rest of the state, because how to achieve those big price tags is a big question, or how to meet them. Next slide. I'll quickly go through freshwater ecosystems. Here, keep in mind, we are not focusing on fully saltwater ecosystems, so I'm not going to talk a lot about our salt marshes, which has been a big focus here and is another point of light. Next slide. Here we're talking about our rivers, our streams, and the fresh to brackish parts of our estuaries. We have these huge current challenges. Our native biodiversity is essentially crashing. Chinook salmon has been doing terribly for the last few years. A species, you know, a really iconic species that is heading toward extinction. We're all hoping that these three decent years of rain might give us a little more time. There's degraded ecosystem health. Our freshwater system is, you know, extremely altered and engineered. We kind of have a system of plumbing almost more than rivers in some places. And here again, we have a funding situation where we have a fiscal orphan. So there is no steady supply of funding. And you're relying a lot on the nonprofit world and philanthropy to try to get some restoration happening in these areas beyond the regulation that's provided. Next slide. Climate effects, again, will make everything worse. Heat is a big problem for our cold water fish assemblages, like salmon, who are largely the ones that are in trouble. We're losing habitat due to drought intensity, and the habitats are already very altered. This is going to change how water is managed. Shasta Reservoir may become essentially a cold water pool that's managed for salmon in the future. So that affects who gets water when. So there could be bigger influences on water supply and use by humans than we're used to due to these changes. And then because these fish have so many bad years in a row, it really inhibits their population recovery. They can't get a good recruitment of young, and then those young grow up and become adults, and then they get a good recruitment of young. If you don't get enough of that in a row, your population just can never get big again. And then, of course, sea level rise is harming estuary habitat. It's shrinking the brackish part of the estuary, and it's going to push into the delta eventually, where we're going to have to use more fresh water to keep the delta fresh for the pumps to Southern California and for the in-delta water use. So it's going to be, again, more and more constraints on our other freshwater. Next slide. There's a lot of things we can do here to adapt. These, I would say, sort of constitute a revolution in how we think about managing these systems. Instead of thinking of the ecosystem as a constraint, the way the ecosystem, the way the Endangered Species Act is currently managed, we'd have to think differently. Like, ecosystem health is our priority. Here's how we're going to use ecosystem-based management to holistically make freshwater ecosystems function well. We have to use newer tools, which we call the Climate Smart Conservation Framework. That might mean actually selecting for different genetic traits. We already have all these salmon and hatcheries. Maybe we need to select for ones that can stand higher temperatures. This is a revolutionary idea for ecologists. Not a widely accepted idea, but we're trying to push on thinking differently, because what we're doing is not working. We're essentially failing our freshwater ecosystems. And then we have to think about contingencies and priorities. What if something does go extinct? How do we plan for that? Should we have tissue archives? Should we know what will happen if the delta smelt are declared extinct? Should we know what will happen to our water management in that moment? And I think at this point, we're not quite ready for that. Next slide. So here again, we give the lowest score of major overhaul needed for ecosystem health. And this is just a map showing that a huge number of species, nearly 1,000 freshwater species, are at risk of extinction by the end of the century in California. So sorry to end on that sober note. Next slide. I'll just tell you what our research priorities are, because part of getting to come to this kind of meeting is to tell you what we're up to and see, you know, hear from you if we're on the right track. Next slide. We plan to do some cross-cutting work on water monitoring and accounting. The value of water in California is so high and the monitoring is incredibly low. And so we've been working with our partners at the State Water Board as well, talking about what could we do to actually understand where water is going. In droughts, millions of acre feet of water disappear in California. We actually don't know where they go. That's worth, you know, potentially many hundreds of thousands to billions of dollars. And those who are losing out are likely junior water rights holders and the environment. And that's one of the reasons people don't want to dedicate water to the environment, is because they don't know if it will get where it's supposed to go. We also want to work on paying for climate adaptation. There's these huge price tags, but no one seems to have a plan for actually how to pay for them, especially if you look, you know, I hear a lot of like money from the federal government or, you know, money from government. The government will not be able to pay for all these things. Even with a different administration, the price tags are very high. So we have to probably prioritize and use different mechanisms. We really want to work on a different approach to freshwater ecosystems. I'm sorry for all the acronyms. Environmental water manager, that means having someone who can manage water for the environment, just like we manage water for people, with releases at different times and rights to that water. Assets for the environment, meaning the environment would actually have different chunks of water that could be used for functional flows. Ecosystem-based management, meaning we don't think of like, I need this fish to do this thing at this time in this place. Rather, we think like, how can our freshwater ecosystems function as a system? My analogy there is that we keep trying to fix freshwater ecosystems like we're tinkering with different parts of a car, but we need to make the whole car run. And just the way we're doing it is not, unfortunately, is not effective. And then we need to use these new tools like being open to genetic management, relocation, those kinds of things. We will continue to work in the San Joaquin Valley, where we do a lot of work with the ag industry on adapting to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, looking at groundwater recharge, land use transitions there. They're going to probably lose about 500,000 to a million acres of irrigated land will not be able to be irrigated anymore, and that's probably going to affect dairies, so we want to do work on that. And then we're really interested in doing work on flooding. We haven't crystallized our ideas here yet. Even fundraising for research on flooding is harder than fundraising for research on all the things above. So it's an interesting, we're experiencing the same challenges as all those who are trying to do better work in this area. So thanks for listening to our priorities. I'd really appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Why don't we have lights up, and I would entertain questions and comments among the board, and then we'll turn to any public comments that may be out there.
Thank you, Dr. Grenier. I, as you know, have immersed in a lot of this, these issues and what's being written about it. And I think this is a very straightforward but sophisticated way of calling attention to the issues that we face. I really, really hope that it comes across as incredibly practical. And I hope that your organization can continue to find the funding to push forward these ideas. I recognize your second little chart here is something Jeremy Lowe produced, you know, but it's refined. It's better. So I hope you will keep doing that. I'm struck by a couple of things. There seem to be very big questions like, do endangered species really make sense anymore? Something we're not going to handle this year. And yet we have to keep teeing these ideas up. The no action alternative is no longer the conservative choice. And so I really appreciate that. But I'm also struck by some very practical straightforward things that you have here, like this ongoing fight just to be able to monitor who's using how much water, which I understand we are finally making progress on, and some senior water rights holders who have never before had to allow their water use to be monitored are facing that now. So I think this is just great. I would encourage my fellow board members and anyone in the audience, if you have not studied at all the Great Flood of 1862, please just like read the Wikipedia entry, because it's an extraordinary thing and it's going to happen again. It's only a matter of when. And despite the fact that we now have dams, you know, that you could sail a boat from Fresno to Sacramento in 1862. Lastly, I just wanted to ask you about your pathways, because it says 0 feet, but that doesn't correspond to a date.
Yeah, thanks.
And it could be like a long time ago, or it could be now.
Yes. So that
really be now, but
right. That was 0 feet was a while ago now, 100 years ago or so.
Okay. I mean, if zero on this graph is, you know, 1875, okay, that makes sense.
That's meant to be a conceptual graph to show that rather than planning by date, we need to plan flexibly around climate change triggers. So the point of that is that your trigger for when you need to raise your levee is not a date. It's when sea level rise gets to X feet. So using that as because we have uncertainty about the date that it will happen, the idea is, okay, you monitor what's happening with climate change. And when you hit one of your triggers, you then implement the action that goes with that amount of sea level rise.
I understand that. Okay. But one date is essential, or you cannot understand your proposal here.
I think that's good feedback. We didn't want to put a date on. We didn't want to be held to the precision of that in a legal way of, you know, well, I actually needed to do tidal marsh restoration 10 years earlier because it's a conceptual diagram, but I hear your feedback.
Right. And given that, you know, we have the president saying sea level will rise a quarter of an inch in 400 years, even though it's already risen 6 inches in his own backyard since 2000, I think that we need to have some reference point here, because this is the, in my opinion, the most effective way I've seen of presenting the nature of the action we'll have to take, whatever the items are. And I think that this would be very helpful for people to see that, in essence, the clock's already ticking. That 0 feet is not in 10 years.
Yeah,
zero
okay.
feet is definitely in the past, as from what I understand of what you're presenting.
Thank you. That's really helpful. I hear you.
Other board member comments or questions?
And has been raised.
I'm going to do board and then public. Jane, please go ahead.
Thanks, Alexis. Leticia, first of all, thank you for the excellent work, and thank you for taking the time to come and speak with us. I guess I have two questions, and I think they might be for Eileen instead of you. But I'm curious about, I mean, I think as a board, as an organization, we have a couple of tools at our disposal in areas where we may not directly regulate, but where we have the opportunity to provide information to all the constituencies, all the communities we work with, and also the opportunity to ask good questions related to, you know, well-found research and future forecast. And so, Eileen, I'm wondering sort of what your thoughts are about, even on our website or as we talk to the regulated community, disseminating this information and outlook. Yeah, maybe I'll just leave it there. Eileen, how do we as an organization work with PPIC and others that are doing fabulous research in these areas?
Great comments. And by the way, thank you so much for coming today. And as you know, Board Member Batty, that in our strategic work plan, we have three organizational priorities. And one of them is, you know, addressing climate change. And so each of our managers and each of our divisions and each of our staff all kind of have been incorporating climate change, whether you're an MPDS permit writer and you're asking that particular wastewater utility, what are you doing to plan for your facility and to address sea level rise, climate change, or as you're going to hear about from Keith Licton here shortly, about a flood management project with the College of Marin, how they're working on creek restoration element. And then our staff are just involved, as you've heard from Alec Noggle and his team and Jessica Watkins and her team, about as they clean up sites in the Bay Area, how they're dealing with climate change, looking at sea level rise, looking at flooding. And then Javier and the planning group, they're involved in a lot of different fronts in the Bay Area, working with a number of different groups, looking at what can we do with climate change. And what we try to do is read the PPIC report, making sure that we, as scientists, engineers, geologists of the Water Board, we're staying current. We're not the ones that are doing the great science that PPIC is doing, but our job as regulators is to make sure we're staying up on the science, that it evolves and changes, and then that we incorporate it into our job as we regulate the regulated community here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it really struck me in particular on the flooding risk, which is maybe not a very, you know, is a topic that is hard for people to get their heads around and until it happens. And so that is one area in particular that, you know, maybe we can do a little bit more to educate our regulated community around the issues there. But anyway, thank you very much.
May I add a comment to that? I think a good thing for this region to think about is you are looking at two different halves of how we're planning for climate change in the state. So on the one hand, you have the state sea level rise guidance. No other water sector has anything like that. It's standardized. There's a bunch of work done in the science, and it tells people, here's a whole way of thinking about what you should plan for. And so people can make all the levees, you know, talk to each other and be the right height, so, you know, it's not spilling over one person's levee and not others. We have nothing like that in the rest of water management. There's no state guidance on flooding or storms or temperature increase. And it's really, to me, it's a very stark contrast coming from the coastal world. So if I go talk to different agencies, there's no standardized planning for a climate future. You know, there's no drought that they plan for. There's no storm that they plan for. Each one is inventing their own thing, or maybe they don't have the resources to do it at all. So expecting every agency, especially the small ones, to be able to do this on their own, I think is very unlikely. And that's one place where the state, I realize you're regional, but where the state could step in more, especially because FEMA, in terms of flooding, really isn't providing enough updated, scientifically accurate, sort of timely information. I know that's a big ask, but it's a very clear contrast when you're thinking about on your sea level rise flooding, I think you're, you know, doing great. But on your riverine and combined flooding, it's a different situation. And part of that is because you don't have the state guidance to go with. Just a thought from the outside.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Any further comments, Xavier?
Well, I would add to that, to Letitia. So to the extent that we have resources available, we are working with the Oakland Alameda Estuary Climate Adaptation Work Group. We recently started engaging with the Canal District in San Rafael. And we do bring up the combined flooding effects, and they are looking at trying to model that. The interesting thing, and something that hasn't been brought up along the coastline, you talk about storm surge and groundwater rise and that all the combined effect. But if you have an earthquake at that time, you also have liquefaction. And so a lot of our areas around the bay are becoming more and more subject to liquefaction. And so we're also bringing that up in these community planning efforts. And we're hoping that San Rafael and Oakland Alameda can sort of be pilot projects that will help other local entities in their planning efforts, along with the regional shoreline adaptation plan that BCDC came out with.
The point is that rising groundwater increases the risk of liquefaction.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. That's a really important point. I appreciate that. There was something else brilliant I was going to ask you, but I can't remember on this.
I appreciate you coming and welcome you coming at any time. Very helpful. Any final comments before I check with Paula about external commenters? We have none. Anything?
Can I ask that we get a copy of the slides?
Certainly.
Thank you. Awesome, Javier.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Grenier. And let's, in a not entirely unrelated way, move to agenda item 8. Eileen?
Great, thank you. So this is a flood risk management project, and it represents coordinated multi-benefit community engaged design that maximizes multiple goals within an urbanized watershed context, including flood management, habitat for fish and other species, and recreation. And I'm going to turn it over to Keith Lichten, who's going to introduce our speakers and the item. Go ahead, Keith.
Great. Thanks, Eileen. I'm thrilled that we have two remarkable speakers, Sandy Goldman from Friends of Corte Madera Creek here in person, and Joanna Dixon from Marin County Flood Control District. We're going to tell us about the Lower College of Marin Corte Madera Creek Flood Management Project. But I wanted to say a few words by way of introduction, Sandy, if that's okay. And just note that this project is really about, at least in part, addressing the sins of the past, and specifically the sins of single-purpose flood management channel design. And you know, this is a seemingly simple project that you're going to hear about, transforming a small part, the lower part of a long concrete channel in Corte Madera Creek, into a multi-benefit creek. And it engages larger questions. You know, how do we design multi-benefit flood management projects? How do we implement that shared vision of multi-benefit design, which is not just protecting people and property, but also supporting fish passage, wildlife habitat, recreation, and some designing projects that are maintainable over the long term. And I'll just note, I'm sure Sandy will get into more details, but the project is an example of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers civil works process and the constraints and opportunities that are presented by that process and imposed. And it's an example of the sedimented constraints of urban development. So it's not just that the team over here has come up with you know, a good design for a creek, but of course they're managing it's the creek's proximity to play fields, to paths, to associated infrastructure, to buildings. And it, you know, so this sort of simplicity of just changing a small part of a concrete channel kind of belies that tremendous complexity, including design, funding, community advocacy, and support that are necessary for it to happen. And for those, here we are in Oakland, we're not too far from Berkeley, and this project sort of evokes for me work that Riley and others did on Lower Cordonesis Creek by University Village in Berkeley. And that reach, the restoration, involved negotiating with soccer moms, was adjacent to playfields, for literally a foot of space for the creek to move on one side. And it required the intervention of a sitting U.S. senator to get the post office to move a fence to give a couple of feet of space for the creek to move on the other side. And I think we'll... Here we have a future U.S. senator involved, so maybe we'll...
No, I'm ready to retire.
So I'm going to... Sandy, maybe I can, with that, hand it over to you. It's a remarkable project.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to hear this description. It's a project that has been near and dear to my heart for years. We see this project as an opportunity to demonstrate restoration in a suburban built-up environment with a lot of constraints, and to provide a demonstration project for what might happen in other places with channelized creeks. Next slide. The slide on the left shows a reach of the creek in Kenfield and Larkspur before the core project. Since you see the narrow meandering channel with lots of tidal wetlands around it. The slide on the right is post-construction. See the over-excavated earthen channel leading up to a narrow concrete channel. As originally conceived, the concrete channel would have been 6.5 miles long and extended into Fairfax, way up in the watershed. After the concrete channel was built into Ross, in 1971, San Anselmo and Fairfax withdrew from the project, and so the reach of the core project was shortened to end at the Sir Francis Drake Bridge, very near the Ross-San Anselmo line. Construction was to have continued in 72, but that was stopped due to litigation, and the current configuration of the channel remains to this day. It is a earthen channel, as you see here, and then the concrete channel up into Ross. A fish ladder was built in 1971 that was supposed to last until the construction season of 72, and in very battered, beaten-up form, it is still there. Next slide, please. Numerous members of the community protested this project. The woman on the left is Marty Kent, one of Roger Kent's daughters. This was right in her neighborhood. Senator Alan Cranston, the senior senator from California, approached the Corps and said that this project really should not continue. And the colonel is reputed to have said, "I'm a colonel, I outrank you, a senator, don't waste your time." And construction continued in another 3 years past this. Next slide. Friends of Corte Madera Creek had long dreamed of removing the concrete channel. We were realistic enough to know that that wouldn't happen. So then we decided to focus on what might be feasible, and that was doing a short project in an area where there were not a lot of buildings right up against the creek. Another major constraint is when the concrete channel was put in, a 39-inch sewer was laid right at the base of the left wall looking downstream. So we focused on laying back the right wall. And in 2017, friends hired Matt Smeltzer, a geomorphologist and engineer, to design a conceptual plan. And this is what he came up with. And it shows the Central College of Marin campus, the Kent Middle School campus, and the Lower College of Marin campus. And those are areas where it's feasible to lay the bank back, landowner willing. With the approval of the flood control district, we presented this plan to the College of Marin Board of Trustees in 1921. And the board was very interested. They were receptive. But they had one problem. It would cause the loss of 6 or 8 parking places. And parking places, as you know, are quite sacred. Anyhow, they did authorize us to proceed to try to raise funding to do a complete design for this short stretch at the bottom by the playing fields. So we submitted several proposals. Finally, in 2019, we submitted one to a fund provided by the Marin Community Foundation, but managed by the Coastal Conservancy, to do 65% designs of what we now call the Lower COM project. And we were granted $200,000. We hired Matt Smeltzer's team, Geomorph Design. Friends took the lead in acquiring permits, working with the flood control district, and all environmental approvals and permits are in hand now. Next slide. Friends held meetings and distributed flyers and has contacted more than 350 stakeholders. Friends maintains an outreach program, and the reception has generally been positive. The main concern has been about the potential loss of a heavily used path and the loss of trees. Well, the trees are acacias, and they'll be replaced. We'll plant a lot more trees than we removed, so that satisfied people. Next slide. In 2021, the College of Marin Board of Trustees approved a new landscape plan. And you see down at the bottom of that, where the creek makes the big curve to the right, they do show our project as being implemented in the final plan. and working with the flood control district and the county real estate agent, we were able to get easements so the project could be built. And we really are grateful to the College of Marin for supporting, you know, giving up land for this project. Next slide. And this shows the 100% landscape design prepared by Pernesky Chatham. The purple is basically sea level now, or 3 or 4 years ago when this was prepared. And you'll see the relatively broad light green band. That's the transition zone. So this is designed so that as sea level rises and the purple area gets wider, the high, low marsh and high marsh bands, the yellow and orange, march up the bank, reducing the transition zone. And we expect this to be responsive for considerable amount of sea level rise. And in fact, the area around it varies from 11 to 12 feet in elevation. And if sea level is that high and nothing has been done to mitigate it, the whole of the lower Ross Valley will be underwater, so not just this area. It's kind of a sobering thought. By 2023, the project had met four crucial milestones: a willing landowner, a supportive local agency responsible for implementing the project, public support, and regulatory approval. The project was shovel ready, but we needed money. And now I'll turn this over to Joanna Dixon, who will describe some of the larger context and the financing.
Hi, everyone. I hope you can hear me. I apologize I can't be there in person today with Sandy, but my name is Joanna Dixon. I'm the civil engineer here at the Marin County Flood Control District and the project manager for this Port of Madera Creek Flood Risk Management Project. The portion of the project that Sandy just described is at the very downstream end of the overall project, which is shown here on the screen on the right in that blue shaded area. And originally, this project was funded by a Department of Water Resources grant, which we got migrated from a previous effort to raise a dam upstream, further upstream in the watershed. And this project was identified as a good solution to maximize the use of those funds. So we've been working on that since, at least 2018, I believe. And it's been through many iterations. And so I just want to apologize because I care about this project so much that I could go on, and I realize we have a limited amount of time to speak with you all today. So I'm going to focus on reading my script and not just carrying on endlessly. So anyway, this map that we're looking at shows the entire project reach. Ross, town of Ross is at the upstream end on the left, where the natural channel is highlighted with a yellow. And then that vertical line that's shown between the yellow and the green is the upstream extent of the existing concrete channel that was constructed by the Army Corps of Engineers. I love that old photo Sandy showed of the protesters there. And it's been that way ever since 1971. So we've got a 50-year situation here that is desperately needing some finalization. This project's been through many iterations along that 50-year journey. And our current effort is to have the Marin County Flood Control District have a locally led project as opposed to the federal completion of the project. So let's see. The main goal of the project is to reduce the flood impacts to the community, which unfortunately occur more often than we would like. I think the Army Corps originally designed this project to be a 250-year storm event project. And unfortunately, we have overtopping of the natural banks into the adjacent streets and neighborhoods at about a 6-year storm return interval. So that's not very pleasant for anyone living in the area that expects more from this project. And the wooden fish ladder structure here at the transition is blamed for that. Mostly as it does obstruct some flows that could otherwise flow from the natural channel down into the wider, deeper concrete channel section. And And that seems to be the main priority of all the community members, to get that wooden fish ladder structure removed and transition the natural channel into the concrete channel. Let's see. The Army Corps of Engineers, when they initially constructed this project, had it constructed in units. So downstream of this image is the natural channel with earthen levees on either side. It's nice and wide. And then it transitions into the concrete channel, which is unit two, all the way up to College Avenue Bridge here in the center of the College of Marine campus. And then unit three extends from College Avenue Bridge up where you see all this green line work. And those are the locations of the improved fish resting pools. There are some small fish resting pools in the concrete channel that don't adequately help fish rest and make their journey upstream. So those will be significantly improved as part of this project. And then, as I discussed, we'll remove that wooden fish ladder and work on the transition into the yellow upstream natural reach up in unit four. So originally, the Frederick Allen Park project here, just immediately at the upstream end of the concrete channel, was to provide the habitat benefits required by the Department of Water Resources grant. But with pressure from the community, the Rothstown Council unfortunately voted to retain the existing concrete channel as it is instead of allowing its removal, which would have widened the creek there and created a lower floodplain park that incorporated the restored creek. So fortunately, our grant managers at the Department of Water Resources allowed the flood control district to shift and utilize this shovel-ready project Sandy mentioned at the downstream end as our habitat component for the overall project. And that restoration will replace what was initially proposed at Frederick Allen Park upstream. Next slide, please. Thank you. This is the grant and park pump station. So this is one of the several components of the overall project that's already been constructed. It started in the fall of 2022 and was just completed last year in 2024. So we've been enjoying watching it function during the last few atmospheric river events we've had. This helps a low-lying neighborhood called Granton Park in Kentfield, which is to the right of this image, where their existing streets and storm drains are a relatively low-lying area. And it works great if the water in the concrete channel is low and gravity has enough head pressure from the storm water system to push the water out. But unfortunately, when Corte Madera Creek channel is full of water, the gravity method doesn't work anymore and water builds up within the neighborhood and there's extensive flooding there. So this new pump station, which is underground system, is able to forcibly push the water into Corte Madera Creek channel from that neighborhood when Corte Madera Creek is full. Incidentally, these concrete walls in this picture on the right side, but as you're looking downstream, it would be on the left side, would be raised about 2 to 3 feet to contain the additional flows that will enter the concrete channel once that wooden fish ladder upstream is removed. And then also concrete channel walls further downstream in unit two, below College Avenue will also be raised as needed for similar reasoning based on the hydraulic modeling that was done. And all this work is planned to occur in 2026 when we hopefully get to the natural channel transition portion of the project. Next slide. Can we go to the next slide?
Check test 1, 2. We just wanted to double check and confirm the folks on Zoom can hear us.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry about the technical difficulty.
Are we back?
Yes. Stand by.
If folks could take their seats, we're going to start in half a minute. Do we have both of our board members?
Jane, yes.
We do have a quorum.
No, that's...
Yeah, that's Paula. Do we have board member Kissinger?
Not yet.
No, he just stepped away for a minute.
Okay. We'd like to go ahead. Joanna, sorry for the interruption. Oh. We're on fish resting pools.
Okay. Yes, thank you. So before I got interrupted, I think we were talking about these amazing new improved fish resting pools. And the modeling from Michael Love and Associates was able to improve our fish passage success rate from somewhere around 5 or 6% up to 95% success rate for fish to get up these low flow conditions in the summer or outmigration or upstream during the winter flows. And these pool images show that in the very darkest blue color of the bottom of the resting pool areas, you can see that the water velocities are less than 1 foot per second. And these were evaluated at the high passage flows of 180 cubic feet per second. So that's some pretty impressive resting opportunity for fish stuck in a concrete channel. 16 new fish resting pools will be constructed as part of the project. And these are planned to be constructed in 2026. Next slide, please. This next slide is addressing the fish ladder structure that we've all mentioned a few times here. So we're looking at the transition between the natural channel on the left side of the photo and the concrete channel with vertical walls and wide flat bottom on the right side of the channel. This was what was constructed back in 1971 as meant for some interim seasonal completion to that phase of work. And it's still there today. You can see it in its battered condition. The individual jump pools underneath the more familiar looking ladder in the center of the picture have pretty much washed out. And, you know, this makes it challenging for fish to get upstream. It also restricts the flow that could enter the concrete channel coming from downstream from up above. And it gets all kinds of debris and everything else hung up on it. And this is the primary reason that most of the people in the community want this project to succeed, to remove this fish ladder and reduce the flood risk in the neighborhood. Let's see what else. Removal of this wooden structure will require extending the concrete wing walls upstream and at an angle back into the adjacent natural channel embankments, so that we can help funnel the flows from the natural channel into the concrete channel. And also the channel bed will be transitioned by a placement of an engineered rock grade control structure, which is also required because we have an existing underground sewer main that transfers sewer flow from the right bank across to the left bank where it goes along behind that concrete channel wall down at the bottom for the length of the concrete channel. Next slide, please. So construction funding, the initial $14 million Department of Water Resources grant was intended to cover the entire life of the project, including CEQA, design, permitting, and construction of all the various project components. But due to the inherent downstream water surface elevation increases caused by removing that wooden fish ladder obstruction, we go from a plunging flow into a smooth laminar flow, which causes inherent water surface rise at the upstream end of the concrete channel. And unfortunately, this project now, because of that, has to undergo a lengthier FEMA review process and a map revision for the flood firm maps, which requires additional hydraulic modeling and a lengthy review process, delaying the construction of those project components that experience that water surface rise as an effect. And I should say that water surface rise sounds scary, but it's really limited to those very small area locations, and all the water surface rise is still contained within the concrete channel. So we're not, you know, having a flood risk reduction project that causes more flooding to the adjacent neighborhoods and communities. Next slide. Oh, excuse me, if we can go back to the long list. I didn't mean for everyone to read all these little individual grant applications, but over the life of this project, we've applied for additional multiple sources of funding, trying to raise extra funds. And I really appreciate the presentation we listened to just before ours that addressed some of the challenges of funding a flood risk reduction project instead of just a restoration or an enhancement project. Because this project really is trying to blend all of the various components of flood risk reduction, ecological improvement, sea level rise adaptation, fish migration, et cetera, into one, you know, kind of holistic improvement project. And so We've been lucky that CME's restoration project at the downstream end has garnered enough support and attention from all these different measures and grant funding sources that we've been able to raise enough additional grant funding to supplement that original Department of Water Resources grant to fund the current upcoming construction of that lower College of Marin restoration project area, which is planned for this summer in 2025. So I think we have 5 of the 12 proposals that were submitted by Friends have been successful in getting this funding. So thank you, Sandy, for your hard work. Next slide. We're also extremely appreciative to the Coastal Conservancy for recommitting the funding that they had previously authorized to construct this lower College of Marin restoration project. And we will, of course, continue to seek any additional funding opportunities as they arise, since the actual costs of construction as they escalate can exceed the current sources of funding we already have. Let's see, collaboration pays off. Thank you so much to the support from College of Marin and the coordination between the Friends of Corte Madera Creek for building those relationships and their perseverance and continued optimism despite our various setbacks along the way has just been essential. And we wouldn't be where we are today without all of these coordinations between our various groups. Thank you again to our former supervisor, County Marin Supervisor Katie Rice, who was also an essential role to bring everyone throughout the community together to see the larger good that this project will deliver. Again, funding from the Coastal Conservancy and the Department of Water Resources has been able to extend our grant source as we undergo the FEMA process is much appreciated. And so the next step for this project is with the Flood District's Board of Supervisors approval, hopefully this coming April, we'll be able to advertise the construction opportunity and open bids for actual costs for this next phase of construction for the lower College of Marin restoration component of the project. Construction is expected to begin in mid-August this year, with work in the creek scheduled to start September 1st. So this collective effort is on the verge of success, and I look forward to additional ways we can collaborate to make these multi-beneficial projects become a reality in our flood-prone areas. Thank you very much for allowing us to present our project today before the board.
Thank you, Joanna. I just want to invite Sandy, if she wants to add anything, or Keith to help us close out. Voila.
I was told to stay here in case there were any questions.
Well, thank you for it. Your presentation. Let me ask the board if there are questions or comments.
So I am struck by Joanna's list of the grants that were sought. Many more were sought than were received. That a key factor in getting this project done was relentless tenacity and countless volunteer hours, which I believe is a kudo to you, Sandy.
Thank you.
And it strikes me that this is the same story we hear every time we have a restoration project that comes before us, that there are individuals with vision and that all the dedicated staff like Joanna need volunteer collaborators to help make all this happen. I also just wanted to point out that the story about the city of Ross not participating really harkens back to me to the Letitia's presentation to us about the need to think differently about what's happening. And with all due respect to the council members in Fort Ross, the story strikes me as being lost in the trees and not seeing the forest here. And maybe it will take a couple more floods for that to happen. But I really am impressed by the scale and the vision here. This is truly an ecological, you know, masterpiece, if you will, in terms of really thinking through not only what you want to have happen, but how it stays functional. And your graphic with the purple color getting larger and larger, I would encourage, as you present this to other people, to not shy away from pointing out what it means when everything is purple, because that's where we're going. And it is, while it is somewhat disturbing, it's also quite truthful. So, but I'm really impressed with what you guys have accomplished. And I hope that, Keith, that I have the sense of, we get one of these stories every 4 months that, I mean, there's something is happening across the Bay Area over the scale of generations with, you know, I thought it was very appropriate that Riley got the Gene Auer Award this year, right? Is that there's this change occurring in different watersheds. And is that pulled together as a story anywhere? Just this, that these kind of changes that are being made that are both ecologically appropriate in terms of multi-benefits, and some of them around anadromous fish, but they're also really beginning to think, being resilient to the future climate that we're entering.
Well, Dr. Gunther, those conversations are happening in a variety of forums. I mean, from the Estuary Blueprint and the Implementation Committee to BAFPA, the Bay Area Floodplain Agencies Association. We're seeing certainly advances in flood control districts like Valley Water with their watershed management planning on Cowdy Creek and other creeks. I mean, I don't need to go down the list, but we can always do better in terms of having more communication about these shared goals and you know, multi-benefit planning. You know.
Well, I'm the work. There's so much work to do every one of these projects. I know that the story that is told frequently is, this is what we had to go through to get this done. But you're part of a larger movement, Sandy, that seems to be occurring around the region. And that kind of synoptic view, that regional view, to me would be quite compelling to be able to tell that story. Just that this is slowly happening. I mean, this is what it looks like if we're going to make our watersheds more resilient to the new climate. And it's happening slowly. Even we often decry how difficult it is and how slow it's going. And you know, what the major overhaul required, that was the term that Letitia used. But we are making progress, and we're getting better. We're getting more sophisticated at how we do this kind of stuff. And so I just, it would be, I'm not sure what the forum is, but it would be great to get this story out beyond just like the State of the Estuary conference, where these stories are told frequently.
No, that's a great point. I think the story is getting out. We can do better. I would just say, you know, there are a lot of moving parts, and one of the ways that we can help set up folks like the Friends for Success and Marin County Flood Control District is thinking about the Corps' authorization process right under the Water Resources Development Acts. And so there's widespread recognition that when we authorize these projects, we need to do so as multi-benefit projects, where the things like trees come on the benefits side of the ledger, not on the cost side of the ledger. And as you know, when the Corps authorizes a single-purpose project, then these additional accoutrements look like costs, and then the projects are not as competitive nationwide for funding. So I think we're developing a community of practice. You know, we talked about some of those folks today, Matt Smeltzer, Roger Leventhal, we could, you know, Riley could go on, that supports that continued effort. But we need to attend to all of the different levers that make it possible.
Anything further from board members? Thank you so much. And Paul, let me check if there's anyone external. Jane, please go ahead.
Sorry, just a quick comment that I have our website open while I'm listening. And we actually, this is one of those cases where we have a very robust watershed management tab on our website. And I think To Andy's point, I mean, it's very productive the way it is, but I think some of these stories could be maybe attached there as a way to continue to encourage community watershed work. So anyway, just a thought.
If I could just add, Alexis, I do a lot of climate change education work, and I struggle with people who tell me that they feel hopeless.
Yeah.
And the antidote to that is doing something. I always tell people, if you haven't changed your light bulbs, change your light bulbs, then you'll be ready for the next thing. And on a community scale, I think these kind of stories are very, very important at getting people kind of off the couch and to recognize there are things we can do. It is a lot of work, but if we get at it and if we are relentlessly tenacious, we can make things happen.
Chair Hacker, if I could make one last point, and I wanted to do a little show and tell to recognize work that the board has supported. And in fact, in 2003 and then in 2020, the board supported Ann Riley to prepare two primers. In 2003, a primer on stream and river protection for the regulator and program manager. And in 2020, a primer on planning stream projects for communities with flood damages. And so these are, you know, how to work with the core process and how to avoid some of the, as we say, the sins of the past. And I'll just note as a preview of coming attractions, one of the issues we are working with our municipal regional permit, stormwater permittees, although that of course is a storm drain permit, is exactly this. You know, how do we coordinate storm drain green infrastructure planning over the long term with you know, stream management, restoring streams and adapting to climate change? And so in approximately two years and change, we hope to bring before you the reissuance of that permit that would more formalize some of these ideas that are currently in very conceptual form with the permittees.
I wanted to thank our guest today, and in particular your organization, Friends of Corte Madera Creek, for tenacity and perseverance and staying there with so many partners and different attempts. And when you get to an important milestone in what good stuff lies ahead, we would be happy to come out on site and celebrate with you and make a little something that we can put on our website so that more people know that this isn't instant pudding, but it's really, really important that we do this. So thank you so much. Yes, we will gladly, but for Bagley Keene, we will gladly be there two by two. Paula, nothing external with that. Board members, we have item 9. I don't believe have any correspondence, which means that now we will be taking a short recess, reconvening on the 15th floor in closed session to discuss with our attorneys the pending litigation cases listed on item 11A of the board agenda. We will be returning, or I will return to this auditorium at just about 12:30 AGP to formally conclude the public session of today's board meeting. And we thank you for your support and participation.
Chair Hacker, before we go to closed session,
go ahead.
Will there be another link that's circulated for the closed session, or will it be this one?
Yeah, we will. Yeah, we'll send it to you in a few minutes, Director Kiss, board member.
Thank you very much. Great.
Bye.
Bye all. Thank you.
Paul, are you ready?
Yes.
Very.
The court reporter is on.
Very good. Agenda item 13. I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Welcome back. This concludes the public session of the February 12th San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your engagement. I'd like to thank our team that makes this hybrid broadcast possible, from AGP, David Fairbanks, Dakota Smith, and Andrew Mamalehu. Our next meeting is scheduled here in this auditorium for March 12th. And we are adjourned.